This is the Tom Hartman Program on AirAmericaRadio.com.
Welcome to the Tom Hartman Program, the No Boring Zone. Tom Hartman.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. What a day. Boy, in the second hour of our program, maybe we'll get into this a little bit in this first hour, but as we move through the show, I really want to get in the second hour of the program into this whole issue of why or why not Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama should embrace each other as running mates, and where that will go, and why it's come to that, why we're at that. But first, there's a bunch of other things going on in the world, and some of them, I think, frankly, have as much to do with life and death as our presidential race, or, well, yeah, without arguing priorities. Donald Payne is on the line, Congressman Donald Payne. He's with the 10th District of New Jersey. He was New Jersey's first African-American congressman, past chairman of the Congressional Black Caucus, member of the Democratic Whip Organization, served as a member of the House Democratic Leadership Advisory Group, and served as in the Congressional Delegation of the United Nations, a member of the Foreign Affairs Committee, and chairman of the Subcommittee on Africa and Global Health, which is my particular interest in this case. Donald Payne, Congressman Payne, welcome to the program.
Great to be on with you.
Thank you so much, sir. You have, I understand from my friend Joe Madison, recently been to the south of Sudan, the Darfur region.
Yes. I, as chairman of the committee, and even before that, of course, have spent a great deal of time during the last 20 years, as a matter of fact, involving myself with Africa in general, but in particular the question of South Sudan. As you know, there was a 21-year civil war that broke out in the late 80s, and Dr. John Garang finally ended up with his SPL, his military, having a ceasefire with the government of Khartoum, and the Comprehensive Peace Agreement was signed, which ended the 21-year civil war, which incidentally, 2 million people died as a result of that long conflict, and 4 million people were displaced. As that was coming to a conclusion, I was at the signing of the peace accords out in Nairobi, and the discussions went on in a place called Naivasha in Kenya, where the agreement was finally made between Dr. Garang and al-Bashir. But as that was being signed, out breaks Darfur, which was very shocking because Darfur, the North-South, was about religion and imposing a Sharia law on Christians and animists and agnostics who did not want to follow Sharia law, and the second-class citizenship of the South from the Arab Northern government.
Right. There was also the issue of the lighter-skinned Arabs of the North versus the darker-skinned Christian and animist Africans in the South.
That's right. And the same situation is in the West and Darfur. The only difference is that the Darfurians are all Muslims, and that's what came out to be so shocking, because it was not about religion, as not that religion justifies it, but these were, as a matter of fact, Darfurians, because they are the poor people, the blackest people in the country, they were part of the military of the North. I mean, so when this attack came on fellow Muslims, it was once again about the fact that it was sort of the Arab slave master mentality over anyone who is pure African.
Well, and in fact, in that region, there has been an active slave trade for several hundred years, and it's still going on, is it not?
That's right. It was broken up with a majority of it was broken up with the Comprehensive Peace Agreement that the South and the North sort of came to the conclusion of the war, but that was a big part of the conflict, because people were put in bondage. They were, as a matter of fact, years ago they used to sell them to to Saudi Arabia, where they had camel races, and the jockeys had to be very light weighted people, and these young boys were the jockeys.
And they were slaves.
Yeah.
Literally slaves.
Absolutely.
We're talking with Congressman Donald Payne from New Jersey's 10th District, a man who's spent a lot of time in and is intimately familiar with many of the challenges and problems of Africa, particularly Central Africa and East Africa. Congressman Joe Madison, as you may know, Joe Madison and I are flying out Monday night, next Monday night, to into Nairobi and then to Juba in southern Sudan and then across toward Darfur by truck. What you've been there recently. What should we expect?
Well, first of all, you'll meet a group of proud people who are trying to start a government. As you know, with the peace agreement, there is the president, Salva Kiir, is the president of South Sudan, but vice president of the government of Sudan. That's supposed to be a power sharing. As you know, most of the oil is in the south. And so the big part of the agreement was that the oil in the south must be shared 50-50 with the south.
With the north, yeah.
Of course, the oil in the north is 100% for the north. But Dr. Garang said at least we're getting 50% of half, which is more than what we got before. And so he had to settle for that. But they're in the process of trying to develop a new government, schools, roads, you know, institutions of higher learning, sanitation, housing. So they simply need help in all areas. And so one thing you'll see is a proud people who fought for their semi-autonomy for 21 years, who now are trying to start the birth of a new nation, really.
Mm-hmm. Now, I hear that there's new outbreaks of violence in the south of Sudan. Right.
There's tension between some groups. It's very isolated, but the government of Sudan there are some evil people in that government, and they, for example, even with the Darfurian rebels, you know, they infiltrate, they create dissension so that there's not a real unified effort, say, in Darfur. Now there are 27 different leaders of rebel groups. Now, how can you negotiate with 27 leaders with one al-Bashir president?
So this was a divide-and-conquer strategy on the
totally,
part of the North?
Absolutely, yeah. Totally. And they're very, very skillful at it. You know, they've been independent since 1956, so they were the first African country to get its independence.
My understanding is that the South, that Southern Sudan, where we're going to be going, was never, although it was technically occupied by the British, really never was occupied. They never went down there. They never built roads. They never built buildings. They never built infrastructure. That most of the area that we're going to be going through is basically just, you know, vast scrubland and local villages that are basically mud, you know, bricks and like this. It's a far more primitive is the wrong word, but it's less developed than the North, which is very well developed with major cities and things.
Oh, absolutely, totally different. I mean, from what I understand, more Lexuses were being imported into Sudan than any other African country. I mean,
but all going into the North, all going into Khartoum.
Right. Yeah. Large buildings. You know, I refuse to go through Khartoum because it's an illegitimate government, and I don't recognize anything illegitimate. So.
Mm-hmm. We have just a minute left. Yeah. We're talking with Congressman Donald Payne of New Jersey's 10th District. Sir, what can Americans do to help the situation in South Sudan and Darfur?
We have to have your listening audience know that there is a problem. That one thing we need to do is to get more congressional support for the fledgling government of South Sudan. So anytime a call, and believe me, they're all recorded, a call or a card or a letter to your congressman, just that we would like to see a solution to the question in Sudan are recorded. That's one easy step. There are several groups that have specific programs that you could pick up off the website. Right. That's very important. And the other thing is we really need to start to get people to know that there are investment opportunities. The South Sudanese people need investment. I mean, no place can move forward without having people investing in
right. Let's take this out of a situation where it's just basically the North and China and put it into a situation where the South is becoming an internationalized area.
Exactly.
Great idea. Great advice. Congressman Donald M. Payne, the 10th District of New Jersey. Sir, thank you so much for dropping by today.
Really my pleasure.
Thank you. And for the great work you're doing. 16 minutes past the hour.
Tom Hartman. Uncommon sense from the radical middle. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Send it.
Welcome back to the most labor-friendly program in all of radiodom, the Tom Hartman Program, brought to you in part by the 200,000 health and hospital workers at SEIU 1199, fighting for quality, affordable health care for all Americans, because keeping our families healthy should be a right, not a privilege. It's amazing. I think about this. My father worked in a union shop all his life. Two of my three brothers are shop stewards in their unions in Lansing. It's just... We have so far to go in the United States economically. We have slid backwards so far, and we've slid backwards in large part as a consequence of insane notions that have been put forward and by and large believed, particularly since the Reagan administration here in the United States. One of the best books on this topic is called Bad Samaritans, The Myth of Free Trade and the Secret History of Capitalism. It's written by economics professor at the University of Cambridge in England on the Faculty of Economics and Politics, Ha-Joon Chang. And Professor Chang, welcome to the program.
Hi.
And thank you for taking our call all the way there in the UK.
Oh, my pleasure.
I loved your book.
Oh, thank you.
As you might have figured out by my review over at BuzzFlash.com.
Yes.
This is just an absolutely spectacular book.
No, I think you're too generous.
No, I am not. You have done a brilliant one. Let's just start at the beginning because we only have about 5 minutes here to talk.
Sure.
The idea that a country is best served by throwing open its doors to so-called free trade,
mm-hmm.
particularly a developing country, but even a developed country
yep.
for that matter, is doctrine. I mean, you'll find everybody in the Republican Party in this country and three-quarters of the Democratic Party would agree with that statement. You call
right,
that
yeah.
statement, I don't recall the exact word, but I would call that statement crazy. Tell me why.
Mm-hmm. Well, this is probably the most enduring myth of our time. But, actually, if you look at the historical record, the countries have done economically much better when they had measured trade opening. I mean, no country really succeeded through total free trade, probably except for Hong Kong. You know, in the 18th century, Britain was the most protectionist country in the world. In the 19th century, and then the early 20th century, the U.S. was the most protected economy in the world. And even after that, you have had countries like Japan, Korea, Germany, all sorts of countries prospering by engaging in the international trade, but in a way that is commensurate with their needs and capabilities. Now, for the developing countries, this is becoming a particularly big problem because these countries have been, in the last 25 years, forced to open their borders when they are not ready. And they had a lot of their industries destroyed and livelihoods threatened. Mm-hmm. But this is also a problem for developed countries because, you know, even if a rich country can usually benefit as a whole from freer trade with other countries, there are winners and losers. And not all the countries have adequate mechanisms to compensate the losers. And you have in the states, states like Ohio being basically wiped out through this
right.
trade policy.
Because of the so-called free trade.
Absolutely.
Your book just does a marvelous job of exploding all these myths and pointing out that the United States had tariffs that ran between 35% and 45% by and large, basically from the founding of our country, certainly the War of 1812,
yeah.
up until more or less the Reagan administration.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, well, it decreased a little bit in the 60s.
In the 70s,
but mm-hmm. yeah, basically until the Second World War, the United States was actually the most protectionist country in the world.
And that built this enormous industrial powerhouse. How do we break the spell of free trade? I mean, you point out in your book, mm-hmm. the Thomas Friedman's book, The Olive Tree and the Lexus, that the Lexus wouldn't have been possible if Japan hadn't protected the Toyota Loom Company, which became the Toyota Car Company.
Exactly.
You know, the Lexus is a consequence of protectionist trade policies, its success. How do we break this spell in the United States?
Well, I think the one thing that the Americans should start doing is to learn its own history well. I mean, here we are. You have a country whose first finance minister, that is Treasury Secretary Alexander Hamilton, invented this protectionist economic theory.
Yes.
A country that has practiced protectionism to its benefit for over a century. And you have scarcely anyone who even knows about this. And when someone like Pat Buchanan says free trade isn't very American thing, people laugh because they don't know their own history. So, yes, I mean, I think that not only that should we talk about today's problems that this unrestrained free trade brings to all countries, we also need, especially the Americans, to look at their own history and try to learn lessons for themselves and for the poorer countries today.
Absolutely. And let me recommend to my listeners, the best history of America's history of trade is Professor Ha Jun Chang's book, economic professor at the University of Cambridge. The book is Bad Samaritans, The Myth of Free Trade and the Secret History of Capitalism. You can buy it at any bookstore. And it's also my BuzzFlash book of the month over at BuzzFlash.com. Professor Chang, thanks so much for being with us today.
Thank you.
And for writing a brilliant book.
Thank you.
It's 27 minutes past the hour, 866-303-2270, our telephone number, tomhartman.com, if you want to drop into our live chat room. Onward we go. Stick around. We'll be right back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
Radio.
Four minutes past the hour. With a yearly 1961, our guest from the last hour, Ha Jun Chang, uses his native country, Korea, South Korea, as one of the models throughout his book of how a country builds itself and how the United States did. As he pointed out correctly, Alexander Hamilton came up with the protectionist trade strategies in his report on manufacturers. In the 1790s, it was given to the George Washington administration when he was Secretary of the Treasury. Alexander Hamilton laid this out, and we followed it for 200 years in this country, and it started being taken apart in the 1970s and 80s, and now it's gone. And he points out how in his country, where he was born in South Korea, in 1961, the average annual income, the total amount of money that a person would earn throughout an entire year, was $82. In 1961, South Korea was more poverty-stricken. It was a poorer country than Ghana, the African country of Ghana, which at that time had a average per capita income of $179 per person. Now, the difference between then and now, Ghana has opened their doors to free trade, and they still have massive poverty. Korea, South Korea, on the other hand, closed their doors to free trade, imposed high import tariffs, became extremely protectionist of local and domestic industries. And now the average per capita income in 2004 was $13,900, about $14,000 a person. From $82 a person a year to $14,000 a person a year from 1961 to today. Purely because they followed the same policies that we followed under Alexander Hamilton, under Abraham Lincoln, who raised tariffs up to 50%. They were in the 30s below that, before that, the mid-30s. through Franklin Roosevelt, through Dwight Eisenhower, till Reagan. By the way, a federal court has just decided, apparently today, this morning, that a 9-year-old girl did, in fact, become autistic, or at least her autism was aggravated by vaccines. Looks to me like Bobby Kennedy's going to be vindicated here in this. 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number. And Khadija in Seattle, you wanted to talk about the Sudan.
Yes, hi, Tom. I'm visiting Seattle, so hi. I was listening to your conversation with Congressman Payne, and I missed hearing any perspective from the Muslim side. For example, could you tell me when did they first discover there was oil in South Sudan?
I don't know, but his point was that the Darfurians were Muslim and the North Sudanese were Muslim, and the North Sudanese are now attacking the Darfurians. That this has nothing to do with Muslim. This has to do with who has the oil.
That's right. So that's right. Because earlier in the conversation, he indicated how the white Arabs were, you know, they were attacking the southern people who are darker, and I thought it was this misconception, because it's the second part of the conversation. It, you know, it automatically discredited the first, because if it's something against Muslims and non-Muslims, and you know, in the South they said they are Christian.
Well, one doesn't necessarily discredit the other, but I don't think that he was asserting that Islam believes in slavery and Christianity doesn't. Christianity has a long history of slavery as well. What he was saying is that in that region of the world, and it's true in many of the countries in that part of the world, that slavery is still alive and well. And in fact, it's still alive and well in Saudi Arabia right now, which, you know.
I don't know. I'm just giving you the Muslim perspective. So among Muslims, this is what we say. They say, you know, the Quran, it did forbid slavery. You know that, right? And the first convert was a black person called Bilal. He was a slave, and how Prophet Muhammad went and, you know, bought him and gave him freedom. So that's the first act he did. Mm-hmm. So it's like for Muslims, it's very hurtful to even hear. But I know, you know, regardless of religion, there are people going to do what they're doing.
Yeah.
So where did they revive this slavery again among Muslims? I mean, some misled Muslims.
Yeah, I honestly don't know the long history of slavery in Africa. It may well be that this is something that was imported from Europe. You know, that the Europeans, I mean, we know that the European slave trade began in Africa in the 1600s. And
these learn from them as well.
I mean, it's entirely possible. I can't offer myself as an authority on that, but it's a good question you raise, and I'm guessing that some of our listeners who are experts on this, I always hear from these folks, from folks who know more than I do, in email,
yeah,
and drop it into our message board over at tomhartman.com will inform us, and I'll pass the information along in a future program, okay?
Thank you so much. Yes.
Thank you, Khadija. Thank you very much for calling, and thank you for listening. Nora in Minneapolis, Minnesota. Hey, Nora, welcome to the program.
Oh, hey, Tom. It's me again.
Hi, me again.
Good to talk to you.
Thank you.
I had been racking my brain and, of course, crying all the time, really disturbed about these delegate problems, and I thought of a fair and practical, comprehensive compromise solution, and I wanted to ask your opinion.
Okay.
And so because they're so disturbed that Florida would cost $25 million, no one wants to pay it, and it's a huge, I mean, who wants to mess with Florida anyway? So my opinion, and everyone was on the ballot, so this is it. Let them pay a fine, like approximately $2 million, make their state pay like a $2 million fine, and accept their delegates as they are, and then make the DNC pay a couple million and get $1 million from each candidate and use it all to go run a new revote in Michigan, because they are the most egregious election because Obama was not on the ballot. And since the Florida would slightly favor Hillary and the Michigan revote would slightly favor Obama.
Well, we don't know. You don't know.
Well,
if Michigan goes the way Ohio just went, then the Michigan revote would be a Hillary Clinton victory.
Yeah, my opinion is if he's allowed to go there for any length of time and the amount of, you know, I don't know. It might be completely even, but, and Florida might slightly favor her, but I'm thinking leave Florida be and get them to pay a fine to get their things accepted.
Yeah, well.
Is that a practical solution? Or?
I think it's a really sweet idea, but here's the problem. Florida is not going to say, yes, we're going to pay for Michigan's revote. You know, their problem and our problem are two separate problems, and, we're not responsible for their problem.
The fine could be just connected to having their...
If you want to find somebody, you should find the Republicans in Florida who decided to do this. I mean, it was
the state legislature, but see...
Which is in Republican hands right now, yeah.
Didn't they? They need to get their voting straightened out so their elections aren't so screwed up.
Yeah.
And they need to get their elections straightened out so they're voting. Vice versa.
It's well said, Nora. Thank you very much. Ultimately, I agree that Michigan is where the real problem is. Florida, you know, everybody was on the ballot. I'll just leave it at that. In Michigan, obviously this was unfair, and obviously something has to be done about it. And $10-20 million in a billion-dollar election cycle is not that much money, frankly. And from the state's point of view, $10 or $20 million. If it's going to cost them $10-15 million to conduct a primary, or it's going to cost the party for that matter, I'm telling you, the candidates are going to spend far more than that in media in the state. You're going to bring a lot of money into that state, a lot of tax revenues into that state. It's going to be a big economic boost for the state. So any state who walks away from this would be, in my opinion, crazy. Mohammed in Tucson, you want to get back to the issue of Sudan? Mohammed?
Yes, I'm on the line.
Yeah, welcome to the program. Thank you.
Yes, Mr. Hartman, you're a good man. I think the congressman troubled me by his statement that he did not recognize the government of Sudan because it's illegitimate. Meanwhile, there is an occupation in Iraq, and he recognized that government. There's an occupation in Palestine, he recognized that government. There's an occupation in Afghanistan, and he recognized that government.
Are you sure that Congressman Payne has recognized all those governments?
I am Sudan, and then... Mm-hmm. Even George Bush, he wasn't elected, and he recognized that government.
Well, George Bush was recognizing the government of Sudan as well.
That's what I'm saying. The thing is, there is a hypocrisy here, and the tone of his talk is all rally around imperialism. There is an imperialistic behavior of most U.S. government employees towards Africa and the Middle East, where they want to impose their will and their way of thinking and everybody lies.
Yeah.
Okay? Now, I do not condone the government of Sudan. As a matter of fact, I have a problem with them. The reason I'm here, because I have a problem with them. Okay? But meanwhile, I am not going to just sit down and let someone to run his mouth and say that this is an illegitimate government, where most of those illegitimate behavior was taught to that system by the United States. Now, the people who are running Sudan right now were originally Muslim Brothers. These people were brought here in America and taught from the CIA of how to run government. Because back then, when the United States needed them to overthrow the Sudanese government at that time...
But again, the U.S. government is recognizing the government in Khartoum.
No, he said it's illegitimate. That's what he said.
But he was speaking for himself. He wasn't speaking on behalf of the U.S. government.
I know, but he's sitting in the Congress. He made a decision.
Right. Well, you know, every member of Congress is entitled to their own opinions.
Meanwhile, he has no problem with people being slaughtered and murdered in Palestine. He has no problem with that.
Well, you don't know that.
I'm
sorry, Mohammed. You don't know that. You should call the congressman's office and if you want to take that up with him. I mean, we were talking about what's going on in the south of Sudan and the Darfur region, and I don't think that anybody can deny that there's a terrible mess going on there, and that something needs to be done about it. 45 minutes past the hour.
Truth in broadcasting. This is the Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
Please impeach me. Let me go.
Okay, we can do that, George.
I've done all the damage I can do. There's only one more thing.
thing I can do for you.
What would that be, George?
I'll be your sacrificial lamb. Serve me up with mint jelly and a side of ham.
I think I'll pass.
And while you're at it, Cheney too.
Okay.
For once, I'll just tell him what to do.
That sounds like a plan. 319 days, 11 hours, 1 minute, and 7 seconds until George W. Bush leaves office voluntarily, assuming he's not impeached first. By the way, a story that we have been following on this program for several days now, it's getting weirder and weirder. I mentioned day before yesterday, I think it was, perhaps the day before that, that one of America's largest defense contractors, United Technologies, had offered to buy one of America's largest voting machine companies, Diebold. And initially, it looked like the thing that Diebold was going to accept the offer, and they wanted to close it in 90 days so that this defense contractor would end up owning their voting machine company, and that the defense contractor is represented by a lobbying firm in Washington, D.C., that is... that's called BKSH, and the founder of and chairman of BKSH and Associates is a guy that, by the name of Charlie Black, who is one of the senior advisors to the John McCain campaign. In fact, was the John McCain surrogate who went on Face the Nation to talk about how John McCain was not all covered with lobbyists. The guy's a lobbyist. And he's a lobbyist for United Technologies, which is now which tried to buy Diebold. Diebold then said yesterday we reported that Reuters was reporting that Diebold said, no, you can't buy us. We're not going to sell it to you at that price. And so today, United Technologies, this defense contractor, whose lobbyist is Charlie Black, says, no, we are going to buy you. This is going to become something like, you know, we're going to get serious about this. I don't know if it's going to be a hostile takeover or what, but they're going to do it. And here's where this story gets even weirder. The parent company of Charlie Black's BKSH and Associates lobbying firm, Charlie Black being high up in the McCain campaign, as well as being the lobbyist for United Technologies, which is trying to buy the voting machine company Diebold, the parent company of Charlie Black's company is called Burston Marsteller. And there's a guy who is the head of Burston Marsteller. This is another big PR powerhouse. Mark Penn, who's the head of the Hillary Clinton campaign, the chief strategist. Mark Penn. So Charlie Black is the lobbyist for the company that's buying the voting machine company. And he's also the guy who's running the John McCain campaign. But his boss is Mark Penn, the guy who's running the Clinton campaign. You tell me the truth isn't stranger than fiction. If I wrote that as a novel, no editor in the United States would buy it. They'd say, come on, give me a break. You cannot suspend disbelief with this storyline. George in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Hey, George, what's up?
Good morning or good afternoon, Tom. I listen to you about every day, and I just want to comment that on C-SPAN today, there was a congressman from Kansas who was complaining that the Defense Department had awarded a contract to the European Consortium to build the new tankers that the Air Force is buying.
Right.
And I think that with the jobs going out of our country, this is going to create immediate 20,000 job loss in Kansas. And with the economy going the way it is, our Department of Defense has to buy American, like Boeing or one of the companies that actually makes things here in the United States.
Well, that's the problem. Here's two problems with that. One is that Boeing is all you got in the United States because, you know, ever since Reagan stopped enforcing the Sherman Antitrust Act, corporations have gotten bigger and bigger and bigger, and all the medium-sized companies that used to be the strength of America have been broken down and chewed up into these giant behemoth corporations. And even Boeing is making a lot of their stuff in China. I mean, they're making tail assemblies and wing assemblies, I understand, in China. Now, a lot of, and bringing this stuff into the United States. So the problem that the press won't talk about is that it is insane trade policies and the lack of enforcement of antitrust legislation in the United States that has caused us to be left with one major aircraft manufacturer in the United States that could compete on this contract, and that one aircraft carrier or aircraft manufacturer, you know, Boeing, blew it in this competition with a European country. I think that if you're going to make aircraft outside the United States, you want to bring them into the United States, you should have to pay a tariff. That there should be, you know, let's have the kind of protectionist legislation that we had in the United States from the founding of this country, put into place by George Washington and Alexander Hamilton, and right up until the days of Jimmy Carter. Let's have that kind of legislation back, and let's, A, break up some of the largest corporations in America so there is competition within America among American companies to provide American jobs, A.
I agree with you on that wholeheartedly, and I realize that, but one other comment. You know, you were talking about Hillary and Barack working out some deal to get their delegates together.
Yeah, I'm going
to
pick it up in the next hour. That's going to be our main topic.
They should work together to maybe have a co-presidency of some kind that would work out.
Well, I think that's going to be real problematic, and it's going to be problematic from the viewpoint of both of them. I know that this is the media darling du jour, and a lot of people would love to see this. And frankly, at the end of the first debates, or not the first debates, but the one, you know, where Hillary reached across and said, "I'm honored to be on the stage with Barack," or actually the one before that, where I think it was Wolf Blitzer said, "What about the two of you on a dream ticket?" And everybody went nuts, and I actually got tears in my eyes. At that point in time, yeah. Now, no. I'll tell you why right after the break.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program, the No Boring Zone. Tom Hartman. Tom Hartman Program. Tom Hartman. Defending America from the weapons of mass deception.
Tom Hartman here with you. The second hour of our program. 6 minutes past the hour. The meme du jour, the thought virus of the day, is how about a Clinton-Obama or Obama-Clinton ticket? Now, because, and again, I want to lay this on the table, I am having this conversation in the absence of an endorsement of either of these candidates. If Hillary Clinton is the Democratic Party's nominee, great. I think she'd make a very good president, and she has certainly demonstrated that she knows how to run a campaign. If Barack Obama is this party's candidate, I think he would make a great president, and he's certainly demonstrated that he knows how to run things, including a campaign. And he has long legislative experience, albeit much of it in the state senate. But nonetheless, he has, and you know, more foreign policy experience than John Kennedy had, or than, well, not John Kennedy, excuse me, than Ronald Reagan had, or than George W. Bush had, etc. I mean, we can go through the thing. Both of them are highly qualified, in my opinion. But this idea that the two of them should team up has a number of problems, and I think that we need to have a clear-eyed, honest discussion that weighs the pros and cons and the history of this, where this is coming to and where it's going, and why. David Sirota has just published a piece in which he's pointing out that Hillary Clinton has been a longtime advocate of NAFTA, for example. In fact, Paul Loeb also has a piece out about this. I'm sure you'll be able to read both of them probably over at Common Dreams, if not now, soon. Suggesting that to the extent that Obama got, you know, lost in Ohio, it was the consequence of an untruth, as it were. That being that Hillary Clinton had never supported NAFTA. this is, and the Canadian, the whole Canadian comment thing, you know, the timeline of this thing with Stephen Harper getting involved in this, and now it turns out that the leak came from one of his top aides, and was this something to help the Clinton campaign? Frankly, I think it was to help the Bush campaign, or the Bush-McCain campaign. Or should we call it the McCain-Bush campaign, for lack of the McBush campaign? It was right, you know, Stephen Harper is a right-winger up in Canada, right in line with what Rush Limbaugh wanted, which is let's have seven more weeks of blood sport here in the Democratic Party. But even that is not the point. Here's the point. In relationship counseling, in couples counseling, in therapy, speaking as somebody who was rostered as a psychotherapist in the state of Vermont for a while, and I've written a bunch of books on psychology and whatnot. One of the core concepts, and this was brilliantly articulated back in the 60s, as I recall, late 60s, early 70s, in a book called The Intimate Enemy. One of the core concepts of how to fight fair is that you never hit below the belt line. Now, there's two assumptions in that. The first is that there is such a thing as fighting fair. And that's true. In fact, it's important in relationships for there to be conflict. Because there are going to be disagreements, and without conflict, by and large, those if one party simply always says, oh, okay, there's never, you're going to have one party over time gunny sacking a whole long list of grievances until finally it blows up and they walk away and the other party's going, oh, what happened? So conflict can be a good thing, a good and useful and important thing. It's important to fight in a relationship, whether it's employee-boss or whether it's husband-wife or whether it's parent-child. It's important to know how to fight, essentially, how to stand up for your position, how to take a position and hold it and like that. Argue your case, and whether you win or lose. Where it becomes dangerous is when, in the course of that fight, a person hits below the belt. Now, here's what I mean by that. I can tell you, having been married to my wife for 35 years, that I know, and frankly, I knew probably within the first 6 months or year that we were married, I know the things that I can say to her that will truly wound her or really hurt her. And she knows the things that she can say to me that will truly wound me or truly hurt me. We know each other that well. And all couples do. And so I never say those things, and she never says those things. We never resort. That's hitting below the belt. So conflict between two people, whether it's in a relationship or whether it's in the political arena, good thing. Hitting below the belt, wounding the other party, bad thing. And I would submit to you that what has happened in the last few weeks, probably at the suggestion of Mark Penn, he certainly seems to be the guy who wants to take credit for it. This Uber lobbyist whose lobbying firm owns the lobbying firm that lobbies on behalf of United Technologies that's in the process of trying to buy Diebold, that the Clinton campaign has hit below the belt. If you go to TomHartmann.com, you will see links to, I got this from Daily Kos, and there's links to the three different stories over on the Kos. In fact, actually, it was on Daily Kos this morning as well, where the Clinton website right now, HillaryClinton.com, at least as of yesterday afternoon when I posted this, is showing a video, an attack video against Barack Obama, in which his skin has been darkened and his face has been elongated slightly to make it look like his nose is wider, making him look more darker, more African-American than he looks. And tragically, there are some Americans to whom that will have some meaning. And this is like what Newsweek did with O.J. I would suggest that that's a below-the-belt attack. The argument that she has experience, John McCain has experience, Barack Obama has a speech, that's a below-the-belt attack. the 3 a.m. ad is a below-the-belt attack. These are woundings. See, you hit somebody below the belt, you can't take it back. It's out there. Now, maybe in a relationship you could just, you know, backpedal for weeks and weeks and weeks, and eventually the wound kind of heals. And people say, well, you know, we saw this before. George Herbert Walker Bush called Reagan's economic policies voodoo economics. Well, yeah. But he didn't call Reagan a voodoo, what do you call it? A practitioner of voodoo, a voodoo high priest. That would have been making it personal. That would have been below the belt. What he said was that the policies were crazy. Now, saying somebody's policy is crazy or is wrong is fine. That is fair fighting. To say that a person is inadequate, incapable, incompetent, unless you can demonstrate that it's just absolutely, demonstrably, irrefutably true, that's hitting below the belt. So you have Hillary Clinton who's suggesting she would take Barack Obama on the ticket. Well, why? Well, because she's behind. Barack Obama has more delegates and has more votes. I know the Clinton campaign camp was out yesterday. They were doing all the talk shows. I certainly got the memo. I shared part of it with you yesterday where they're saying, oh, no, there's just a few thousand votes, a few 10,000 votes difference between Clinton and Obama. Well, that's if you include Michigan, where Obama was not on the ballot, and Florida. If you take Michigan and Florida out of the equation, there is a significant difference, and Obama has a significant lead, which she will not be able to catch up unless she has overwhelming wins in every single state from now till the end, which is not going to happen. Which is not to say she's going to lose them, but I'm talking overwhelming wins, and she can get the majority of the superdelegates to flip her way. So it's to her advantage right now for Obama to say, yeah, sure, I'd love to be your vice president. I'll quit campaigning. Obama, on the other hand, and the problem that you have with that then is that those below the belt attacks that she used against him will then be used by John McCain against the both of them as a ticket. So now the Democratic Party has a problem as a consequence of these campaign efforts up to this point. The Obama campaign, on the other hand, being ahead, would be crazy to say, sure, we'll put Hillary Clinton on the ticket right now. And in fact, given the nature of the attacks on him, by putting her on the ticket, they would be essentially ratifying her below-the-belt charges. So I think that, frankly, from that time when the debate happened 5-6 weeks ago, whenever it was, where Wolf Blitzer said, how about the two of you and everybody, kumbaya, till now, things have changed.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. News without conflicts of global corporate interest. The Tom Hartman Program.
Taking my country back. Been treating my stars and stripes. You took our jobs and sent them overseas. Now we owe billions to the red Chinese. You blew the budget and you bossed Iraq. So I'm taking my country back.
We're taking our country back! One candidate at a time. We're going to start. We did this 2 years ago, every week leading up to the election. We're going to start again today. We're going to get back, by the way, to our conversation about Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton and who can hook up with who, how in the presidential and vice presidential at the bottom of the hour. We'll be taking your calls on the topic. But right now, we have, they say fixing Washington isn't rocket science, right? But maybe it is. Maybe we need a rocket scientist. Bill Foster. Bill, welcome to the program.
Welcome. Hi, Tom. It's great to be on.
Thank you. Foster08.com is the website. Bill Foster is the guy who is running for Denny Hastert's empty seat in Chicago. For our listeners on WCPH, or CHD, the seat, here we have a Republican seat that is going to, that could flip Democratic if you win this election. There's going to be a special election on Saturday, and in fact, here, let me just play this very quickly. I think this is a great endorsement that you have, Bill.
Okay.
except it's not playing for some reason. Ah, hang on just a second. Here we go. Let's restart it.
You may think you have to wait until November to vote for change, but here in Illinois, you can start Saturday, March 8th. That's when you can vote to send Bill Foster to Congress. Bill Foster helped start a business, then was a scientist for over 20 years at Fermilab in Batavia. He'll focus on changing Washington to get results. This is Barack Obama, and I endorse Bill Foster for Congress because he represents the change we need.
There you go. You've endorsed by Barack Obama. Not too shabby, sir.
What? That's right. I can't imagine a better way to close out a campaign in Illinois.
Right. So, Bill Foster, you're running for the seat that Denny Hastert has left. Foster08.com, the website. Why should Democrats show up in Chicago or in Illinois, this in your congressional district? Which congressional district is this?
This is Illinois 14th.
To the 14th.
It's the western suburbs of Chicago, and then a swath of basically farmland, mainly farmland, going out almost to the Mississippi River.
Great. So why should Democrats go out of their way on Saturday to go vote in this election?
Well, I think that in this case, we've got a really clear distinction to be made here. The Republican we're running against is to the right of Dennis Hastert on almost everything. He's a guy that's really aligned himself with almost every single one of George Bush's policies. You know, he wants to keep our troops in Iraq for 10 years. He wants to abolish employer-provided health care insurance. He's against children's health insurance and the S-CHIP program, and in fact is generally speaking against health insurance being provided, health care being provided in any way, shape, or form by the government. And so it's a very clear set of distinctions.
This is Jim Oberweis is his problem?
Jim Oberweis is the guy's name. That's right.
And you're suggesting he has... Go ahead.
Yeah, one of the interesting things that just happened is that the Chicago Tribune, which is always endorses Republicans, has actually come out in our favor. And the interesting thing about that is that the reason they did it is that they just weren't happy with the very negative and factually incorrect way that he's going about the attack ads in this thing.
Yeah, in fact, your website over at Foster08.com says Jim Oberweis has a problem with the truth. That's a pretty strong statement.
Yeah, you can see a stronger statement than that if you go to the Chicago Tribune website, and I urge you all to do that, and you can see what they think about it. And
Illinois is having a... I'm sorry, go ahead.
The exciting thing about this race is that it's really in play. You know, it's going to send shockwaves when the Democrats capture this thing. It's been a Republican flagship seat for generations, and right now, the Cook Report rates it as a toss-up, and Roll Call Magazine just put out a poll that shows us 7 points up, which is, you know, phenomenal. And
right.
The thing about the Saturday special election is that it really gives an opportunity for people from all over the district to come out and help get out the vote. And
right.
So we're having just a tremendous amount of enthusiasm. It's a good opportunity to get out the vote for working people and people holding down two jobs. So the Saturday special election is a very interesting experiment in electoral politics.
Is this only in the 14th district?
That's right.
The Saturday election.
The election triggered when Dennis Hastert quit about 3 months ago.
Right.
And so there's also going to be the normal election in November, but we're obviously focusing on this. And
right. We have about 30 seconds, sir. Your final elevator speech.
Sure. Well, I'll just tell you a little bit about me. I'm a scientist. I worked at Fermi National Lab for 22 years. Our campaign has been endorsed by 31 Nobel Prize winners. I'm also a businessman who started a business in my basement with my little brother, and now that business makes about 70% of all the theater lighting equipment in the U.S. And so I really have everything that's needed to speak to the independents and to the Democrats of this district. And
sound like the right man for the right job at the right time. Bill Foster, his website, Foster08.com, Foster08.com. And check it out for our listeners in Chicago. Get out there this Saturday, and if you're in the 14th District of Illinois, and vote for Bill Foster. Bill, thanks a lot for being on the program.
Thank you.
27 minutes past the hour.
You're tuned in to the Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
coming back 34 minutes past the hour. You know, it's like, it's okay, back to the original topic of the hour, it's okay to hit below the belt if you have no hope. I mean, it's really, you know, arguably bad taste and just generally not a good idea. But if you have no hope or expectation of ever having to interact with that person for the rest of your life, see, I would say even then it's dicey. But for example, like when the Swift Boat veterans rolled out the thing against John Kerry, this was so below the belt. I mean, it was so below the belt that John Kerry was so shocked by it that for 20 days he didn't say anything. I mean, that's how shockingly below the belt it was. And I'm guessing that those guys figured they would never again ever have to deal with John Kerry. And somehow the Republicans in the Senate who supported the Swift Boat guys or who didn't condemn them there's some kind of weird protocol like, well, the gentleman from or the gentlewoman from, you know, and all this kind of, you know, the pomp and ceremony seems to allow politicians to get past that. Oh, it's just politics. It's like in business. You say, oh, it's just business. Nothing personal. It's just business. I'll destroy you. It's just business. And actually, you know, some people can kind of disassociate that. And I think that for most Americans, the notion it's just politics will actually, at least over time, fly when we're talking about opposing parties. When a Democrat is taking on a Republican or a Republican is taking on a Democrat and they hit below the belt, they attack in a way that is perceived as essentially unfair. Dick Cheney, before the 2004 election, talking about the Kerry Edwards ticket and saying, if you elect the Democrats, terrorists are going to hit us again. That was so below the belt. But he didn't care. I mean, he doesn't have any intention of ever working with Democrats. Which is a tragic and sad commentary on Dick Cheney. But again, when you hit below the belt within your own party, it becomes far more problematic. This is what Ronald Reagan was talking about with his 11th commandment, thou shalt not criticize another Republican. And it becomes even more problematic when you're talking about having to essentially politically marry that person to be in an eight-year relationship with that person, or at least a four-year relationship with that person as president and vice president. Even Lyndon Johnson and John Kennedy, and maybe some historian will correct me on this, but my recollection is that Lyndon Johnson and John Kennedy, who did not like each other at all. Kennedy served in the Senate. Johnson was the Senate leader, the Senate majority leader. And Johnson used to just ride herd on people. In fact, there's a story about how LBJ took the chairman of the Fed at the time, I think his name was Martin, into his office. And he was all upset because the chairman of the Fed, as they were running up to the election of, what would it have been, the election of 68, I guess, was running up interest rates, which was hurting the economy. And LBJ took this guy into his office and slammed him up against the wall, physically slammed him up against the wall and threatened him with a fist. He still didn't lower interest rates, by the way. But later he did, actually. He did go along with what LBJ wanted. But the point is that, I mean, you know, LBJ could be pretty damn abrasive. But even at that, Jack Kennedy didn't say, oh, this guy's an SOB. You know, back in Texas, they say that he murdered his first congressional opponent. Yeah, I mean, then there was that rumor mill. I mean, that would have been hit below the belt. And John Kennedy just never did it, to the best of my knowledge. And neither did LBJ to Kennedy. And so they were able to act as president and vice president together, albeit not as friends. So, Daryl in New York City, you disagree with me.
Hello?
Yes, sir. You're on the air.
Hey, Tom. It's a pleasure to talk to you. I'm Daryl from New York.
Thank you.
I'm an African-American male. I was a supporter of Edwards, and now I'm a supporter of Hillary. And I tell you, I don't think the 3 a.m. ad was under the belt, was, you know, hitting below the belt at all. I think it was politics. And I think it's fair to ask that question. You know, you've got a one-term senator who's never spent any time in the White House and has never really visited world leaders.
So you're talking like George W. Bush. who had never been in the Senate, who had never been outside the United States except to go to Mexico to get drunk.
And you see what we get with. Joseph.
Okay, so you're talking Abraham. You're talking Abraham Lincoln, who was a one-term senator, or you're talking. I mean, you know, I can give you a whole bunch of examples here of people who had a whole lot less experience. It's not the experience. Now, see, here's the problem. What you and I are doing right now, Daryl, and I just caught myself, is we're debating that frame. And that frame is not the Democratic Party frame. That frame is the Republican Party frame. That's an ad that Republicans run to say that Americans should be making their voting decisions based on how frightened they are and who they think is going to be the big daddy or big mommy to protect them.
I disagree with you. That is
the Republican frame. The Democratic frame, and nobody has said this. Actually, Barack Obama has said this to some extent, but he hasn't said it the way I'd like to hear him say it. The Democratic frame is, and certainly in a lot of local races, and should be, I think, at the national level, we're Americans and we're not afraid.
I think both are fair. I think it's fair to ask the question. Now, look, here's the deal, I think, from my point of view. Barack Obama, he's going to come up against a whole lot worse than this.
That's right.
He is the
candidate. That's right. But what's going to happen is that when he comes up against a whole lot of worse than this from John McCain, Democrats will discount it. When he comes up with this kind of thing from Democrats, Democrats are wounded.
See, I don't think that we have to be that protective of Barack Obama. I think this is something that
I'm not talking about protection. And what I'm saying is that Hillary has hurt herself with this. This is, and I'm not saying this that as a consequence of this, I would vote for Hillary or vote for Barack Obama. I'm not, you know, I'm really not saying there's the therefore in this is that it's going to be very difficult for these two people to work together after this, both personally and in particular politically. And that the Republicans have been handed, you know, just a great prize. See, when a Republican hits below the belt against a Democrat, if John McCain, and Daryl, thanks for the call. If John McCain was to use this exact same meme against Barack Obama, without Hillary having done it first, Obama could say, come on, give me a break. I'm cool, calm, and collected. You've seen me through 20 debates. You've seen me in the United States Senate. I was in the Illinois Senate. I was an organizer on the mean streets of Chicago. I've been to hell and back. I've got the judgment. He could say that. But now when John McCain says, you really want Barack Obama answering that call at 3 in the morning? Because Hillary Clinton says you can't trust him to. The Democrats say you can't trust him to. See, that's where it becomes damage is done, frankly. In my opinion. Rob in Seattle. Hey, Rob.
Hey, Tom. Boy, I've listened to you many times and tried to call in before. I'll make this really brief. We've got 2 points, and it ties right into what you're talking about. What Hillary has done is damaged the party and damaged its chances coming up in the November election.
And my point is that she's damaged herself.
Absolutely. But it goes beyond just herself. And the concern that I have is on political.com ran last night. I saw it when I was at work. There is a 527 group. I remember Hillary decrying the use during the Bush administration, the Rovian technique of these third parties that you can dissociate yourself from running the attack ads. And she talked about how bad that was. Well, we're seeing that right now. And right now there's a group that is raising money, preparing. They actually ran the ads, $864,000 worth of ads in the Texas and Ohio campaigns. They are preparing to lower the bomb on Barack in Pennsylvania. The group is a pro-Hillary group, and the article on political.com details who's contributed. But the very interesting part is William Teitelman, who's a longtime Clinton fundraiser, is in the driver's seat in this group, very influential in this group, and he is an attorney with ties to former president, Pennsylvania Republican governor and McCain backer, Tom Ridge.
What we're talking about here is that the Rush Limbaugh scenario, the scenario that Rush Limbaugh was asking for, let's bloody up Barack Obama a little more, is exactly what's happening.
You bet.
Rush Limbaugh is getting his dream.
And they're aiming for a lot more money for Pennsylvania. And I have to, the thing that to me is a concern. This is disingenuous. This is why I have not wanted to support Hillary, and not just in this campaign.
Yeah, well, see, I don't even see it as a matter of supporting or not supporting Hillary or Obama, Barack Obama. I see it rather as we the people should be saying to these two campaigns, we don't like this kind of campaigning. This kind
Absolutely.
Of campaigning is hurting us. It's hurting us as Democrats. It's hurting us as American citizens. It's hurting the party. And enough already, stop it. And,
right.
you know, yesterday I actually, you know, I made the point that, well, Barack Obama has hit back against Hillary. He's, you know, with his response to the 3 a.m. ad. But the reality is that his response to the 3 a.m. ad was more putting himself forward, and it wasn't hitting below the belt.
Absolutely.
It was talking about policy rather than personality. And that's the problem. And that you've got to get to the issue. And Rob, thank you for the call. You've got to get to and stay in a primary where you're talking about within your own party to the issues of policy and not personality. You hit above the belt. You hit as hard as you can, but you hit above the belt. 45 minutes past the hour.
Tom Hartman, helping you win the water cooler wars. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. 9.5 minutes before the hour. Interesting. I had posted over at Daily Kos for 3 days now. There had been this post about, did Hillary Clinton darken Barack Obama in an ad that's running on her website? And I picked up the post off the Kos, particularly after Marcos himself said, yep, definitely. And put it on my website at tomhartman.com. And with the appropriate links to Hillary Clinton's website and to the Daily Kos, to three different threads on Daily Kos. There's now a new thread on Daily Kos making a pretty persuasive case that, in fact, this is just kind of what happens when you can start converting video, when you start playing with video. So I refer you over to Daily Kos on that. I may well, you know, maybe we are all guilty of being hysterical here on that particular issue. Could be. I don't know. We'll let this shake out for another day or so. Joanne in Seattle. Hey, Joanne, what's up?
Yeah, to me, the biggest reason that Hillary can't pick him for vice president is that she's telling him he's not qualified. He made a speech. You know, that's all he has to show.
Right. That was my point, that once you
right.
when you've hit somebody below the belt like that, you can't just take it back. You know, if she said we disagree on policy and we're going to continue that disagreement, you know, John Edwards and John Kerry disagreed on a number of policy issues, and Edwards said, "Okay, I disagree with him, but I'm going to keep my mouth shut now that I'm his vice presidential nominee because he's the president, we're going to do it his way." That's a whole different thing than saying, "Well, I guess I'm a bumbling incompetent, but I'll be vice president."
You know, I have one other point, if I may, and that's that Hillary's like all gloating about all the votes she got in Ohio and Texas. And I think she got a lot of people because there was no point in voting for McCain. And I think they want to run against Hillary.
Well, this is certainly what Rush Limbaugh was calling for, and we'll see. We'll see.
And she's just gloating. I mean, I think she's almost drunk with this, what she imagines to be a success, and I don't think it is.
Yeah, yeah. We'll see how it shakes out. Thanks a lot, Joanne, for the call. By the way, every week we do a segment, just a very quick, a couple of minutes here, to tell you about advertising successes in Progressive Talk Radio. And today, I just wanted to bring on Dean, is it Sycon?
Sycon.
Yeah, Dean Sycon with Dean's Beans, organic coffee company. Deansbeans.com is the website. And Dean, give us a one-minute elevator speech on your product, first of all.
Well, we're 100% fair trade organic coffee company in Massachusetts, and I designed Dean's Beans 15 years ago to be a vehicle for taking progressive values out into the workplace and showing that business could be a vehicle to heal the world, not hurt it. It's the way I can get off of this floor.
Yeah, okay. And your product is available on the web?
Yeah, about it's amazing, about a third of our sales are on the web these days, and we're also available in independent cafes and markets around the country.
Okay, and so cafe owners and whatnot can order from deansbeans.com as well. Mm-hmm. And you've been advertising on Progressive Talk Radio. How and where?
Well, WRSI here in Northampton, Massachusetts, and we take a very different tack than standard advertising. We put out one-minute commercials that are situational, such as in the Office of Homeland Security, a visit to Santa, the International Coffee Cupping Competition, which are spoof shots, but they try to educate the consumer as to important issues and then obviously let them know that, you know, we're right there to support them in their values as well.
So you found that one of the most effective ways to get business, to actually sell product on Progressive Talk Radio, is to do ads that have a political progressive component to them as well as a pushing the product component.
Well, you know, we take ourselves very seriously, but we also don't take ourselves that seriously because that's a balance that we progressives have to find.
There you go.
So, yeah, it's been very successful. People know that we stand behind our values. We don't advertise per se. We tell the truth, and we have fun doing it.
Yeah, great.
We have a great product.
You do. DeansBeans.com is the website. Deans Beans Organic Coffee Company. Dean, thanks a lot for being with us.
Pleasure, Tom. Keep up the good work.
Thanks. You too. Good talking with you.
Bye.
866-303-2270. Gary in New York City. Hey, Gary.
Hi, Tom. How you doing?
Great, but I'll get better. What's up?
It's actually kind of funny that you got the guy on for Deans Beans because I'm actually drinking a cup of their Berkeley Sharp Bite. It's absolutely amazing.
Really? Well, that's a coincidence.
I wanted to make a couple of basic points. Have you noticed that it's only Hillary supporters who keep suggesting a Clinton-Obama or Obama-Clinton ticket?
Well, that's my point. She's behind, so it's to her advantage. Right now, if he were to say, sure, I'll be vice president, that's the most probable way that she could instantly become president or become presidential nominee. On the other hand, I'm not sure what's in it for him to have her as vice president.
I don't think there's anything in it for him. I actually think that it will actually be going backwards for him.
Yeah, I suspect that that's the case. I mean, that's just my, you know, looking at it, you know, with not so much as a voter, but as an observer of the political scene. I think that, you know, if he were to have, you know, Wesley Clark or John Edwards or somebody like that on the ticket with him, you know, somebody who has military experience, somebody who already ran for vice president, who's already been vetted, you know, somebody who's a good progressive, somebody who has broad appeal, Bill Richardson, another one.
Actually, you know who I was actually thinking? I was actually thinking about Marine Corps General James Jones.
Hmm. Well, the problem with him is that he doesn't have that kind of name recognition. Then you're back to the...
But, you know, when you consider that, you know, he wrote a position paper that's critical of the plan for Iraqi freedom, mm-hmm. and instead of retiring him like they did to General Zinni, they promoted him from Commandant of the Marine Corps to Supreme Commander Allied Forces of NATO. So, you know... While he might not have like the same name recognition as Wesley Clark, because Wesley Clark ran for president.
Yeah.
But I think he has like a level of what's the word? You know, when
gravitas, perhaps.
Yeah.
I'm just concerned that it would be an Admiral Stockdale or Stockton moment. You know, Ross Perot's running mate. Who am I? What am I doing here? But yeah, your point is well taken, Gary, and I thank you for calling and making it. And, you know, we'll continue the conversation as we go on through the show, and certainly as we go on through the campaign season, we're going to see how all this stuff shakes out. 57 minutes past the hour here on the Tom Hartman Program. Coming up, Michael Scheuer is going to tell us about his role in our rendition program.
The Tom Hartman Program, taking back the mainstream media. 3 hours a day, 5 days a week. The Tom Hartman Program. Tom Hartman. Where smart people get their news.
So what are the presidential candidates, Republicans and Democrats, fail to understand about this war, and is it even a war, with militant Islam? How is it that we don't understand history? How are our policies and values out of line with our founding fathers' vision? Michael Scheuer was the head of the Osama bin Laden tracking unit at the Counterterrorist Center for the Central Intelligence Agency from 1996 to 1999. Worked as a special advisor to the chief of the bin Laden unit from September 2001 to November 2004, and was the first chief of the U.S. government's rendition program. He resigned from the CIA in 2004. His last book, New York Times bestseller, Imperial Hubris, He's adjunct professor of security studies at Georgetown University, senior fellow at the Jamestown Foundation, and he has a new book out. It's called Marching Toward Hell, America and Islam After Iraq. Michael Scheuer, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much, sir. I'm glad to be here.
Glad to have you back with us. I think it's been about a year since you were on, when your last book came out, in fact.
Yes,
that's
sir.
The last time we talked. How is it that all the Democrats and all the Republicans misunderstand what is characterized as a war with militant Islam?
I think it's just simply the matter of politics, sir. We are much more comfortable with telling the American people that we're at war because the Muslims and Islamists hate our freedoms and our liberties and women in the workplace and because I have draft beer after work. No one wants to lose their lifestyle, and it's easy to understand, but it happens to be wrong. That's an enemy that only exists in the minds of our leaders. The war is all about the impact of our policy in the Muslim world. And until we get that straight, we're never going to be able to understand the threat that they pose to America.
You know, the only presidential candidate that I can think of who clearly said what you just said was Ron Paul.
Yes, that's correct, sir. And he was identified as everything from a traitor to an American hater to an anti-Semite.
To a crackpot.
To a crackpot, that's right, sir.
Which is perhaps the most destructive charge.
Yes. And Mr. Paul didn't even get a chance to give his own evaluation of those policies. He was just trying to make people understand that if you don't understand the enemy, you get beaten by him.
Mm-hmm.
And he was certainly shouted down by Giuliani, and the rest of them went along with it.
Sure. And in your book, Marching Toward Hell, you suggest that we are being beaten, and in Afghanistan in particular, and that we will lose that country just like the Russians did.
I think that's exactly right, sir. We tend to, our leaders tend to denigrate and cast hatred toward our enemies, which I suppose that's ultimately inevitable in any war. But if you look at our position from the view of the enemy, Bin Laden, Al Qaeda, and his allies have enunciated three goals in this war: to bleed America to bankruptcy, to spread out our military forces to decrease their potency, and to break up our political cohesion at home.
They've done all three.
I think all three have happened to some extent, partly because of their action, but primarily because we don't know what the enemy's about here, and he can't win with us without us helping him, and we're helping him very much at the moment.
Now, him being Osama bin Laden, in 1996, Osama bin Laden essentially declared war on the United States. The Collected Writings of Osama bin Laden was one of my BuzzFlash Book of the Months about a year and a half, 2 years ago when it came out. And it was frankly startling to me to sit there for, I probably spent 8 hours or so, 9 hours reading through that book. You know, I didn't literally read every word of his cover to cover, but I read a good chunk of it. And a lot of it was reflective. A lot of it was, I don't know quite how to say it without it sounding almost like praise, which I don't intend it to be. But he came across as a nationalist, as a person who believed that he was fulfilling a higher calling, that he felt himself to be the victim, he and his people to be the victim of the United States and our policies, and that he was doing the right thing. And you know, obviously, you and I would both disagree that he was doing the right thing and et cetera. But if we don't deal with his perception, why exactly did Osama bin Laden, in your opinion, declare war on the United States in 96?
I think there's a number of reasons. The immediate cause of it was the kind of straw that broke the camel's back was the American and Western occupation or presence in the Arabian Peninsula during the first Gulf War.
That would be the Air Force base that the Saudis let us take over, the Prince Bandar bin Sultan or whatever it is, Air Force base.
And then also we accumulated about 500,000 troops in Saudi Arabia before the first invasion of Iraq in 91, and right. We have never left since then.
Well, actually, we left about 6 or 8 months ago, didn't we? Didn't George Bush pull all those troops out?
Well, we kind of pulled the hair over our own eyes, Tom. And what the prophet said and what bin Laden is reacting to is the prophet's words that no one but Muslims should be on the Arabian Peninsula.
Right.
we moved from Saudi Arabia to Kuwait and Qatar.
Which is still the Arabian Peninsula.
Which is still there. We thought we pulled the rug out from under him, and really, for a Muslim, the Prophet's homeland is the whole Arabian Peninsula. The real reason, I think, or the overall reason that bin Laden declared war on us was he sees us as the main protector, enabler, if you will, of the main enemies of Muslims, which are Israel and the governments that rule the Arab states, whether it's Saudi Arabia, Egypt, Jordan, Algeria, take your pick.
Right.
And their view is, and time will tell whether it's correct or not, but their analysis is that none of those countries can exist without the support of the United States. And so their goal is not so much to defeat us as to drive us as far as possible out of the Middle East. We're not even their main enemy in many ways. We're kind of in the way of them getting at their main enemies.
Which is Saudi Arabia, Egypt, Israel, and
yes,
Jordan,
sir.
For example, countries that are basically secular governments.
Well, secular police states. I think if you read...
I can't call Israel a police state.
No, that's true. But, I mean, of the Arabs, those are police states. There's a lot of talk these days about Islamofascists being out there. And there's lots of them out there, but they're all on our side.
In other words, they're Muslims who are secular, who are running secular police states, fascistic police states like Saudi Arabia and Egypt. And, how does Morocco? Morocco is a democracy. They don't fit into this, do they?
Well, it's a democracy in the sense that if you agree with the government, you vote. But it's still a very strong authoritarian state.
Well, Iraq was a strong authoritarian state,
yes,
and a secular state, and it was held together by a strong man. And from speaking with Iraqis who, lived in Iraq for a long, long time, what I've been hearing is they would love to have Saddam Hussein back. I mean, it's...
Oh, and I think America would love, if we had any sense, we would love to have him back. He was our de facto ally against Al-Qaeda and its allies.
Right.
As long as he was there, the bottle was corked.
Right. And so the what's in the bottle then is this virulent radical form of Islam that really began with Wahhabism?
Yes. And began with, quite frankly, the more I study it, sir, there's a great element of liberation involved in this. Not liberation in the sense of the American Revolution, but liberation in the sense of ridding those countries of un-Islamic Arab police states. Mm. And I think we're really standing against the tide of history here in many ways.
So should we just step back and let Egypt fall and let Jordan fall Qatar fall? I doubt Israel would fall, frankly, but let the other states fall.
Well, really, we don't have that option, sir. One of the realities for Americans is we frittered away our independence in the sense of having options in foreign policy. Until we do something about energy in the sense of making ourselves self-sufficient, we're tied to the Middle East exactly as we are today.
Mm.
As long as we need Kuwait, Saudi Arabia, United Arab Emirates as the swing oil producers, and our allies need them, we have no choice but to defend them.
Right.
And
but if we did pull back, it would be the return of the Ottoman Empire, wouldn't it?
Well,
it'd be worse than that. The Ottoman Empire was arguably semi-secular.
It was semi-secular, but I think what we tend to view Muslims as being homogenous, and they are a more fractured civilization than we are. The idea that they're going to unite if we're gone probably is incorrect. In fact, our absence would probably make them fracture.
Fascinating. Marching Toward Hell is the book, America and Islam After Iraq. Michael Scheuer, the author. Michael, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me, sir.
Good talking with you. 16 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program, where despair is not an option. Get active.
It was about 5:05 on Friday, and we were all getting ready to go.
Oh, yeah.
And the boss man started screaming, and his band began to show. He said, you come with me, cause you're going out to step. When my heart was thumping, I was jumping. I
to get away. Some days you gotta dance and live it up when you get the chance. Cause when the world doesn't make no sense, then you're feeling just a little too tense. Gotta loosen up those chains and dance.
A fine day to dance. The Tom Hartman Program, by the way, brought to you by the 200,000 health and in part by the 200,000 health and hospital workers at SEIU 1199, fighting for quality, affordable health care for all Americans, because keeping our families healthy should be a right, not a privilege. Very interesting. The just got an email here from Mark Crispin Miller about from Reason Online. It's Rush What Won It over at the Reason.com blog. I'm going to have to post this, cross-post this. We'll put it up on our website. It'll probably take about an hour to get there. But suggesting that, yeah, it was Limbaugh who made it happen in Ohio and Texas. I don't know. Joan in Montana. Hey, Joan, welcome to the program.
Hi there. How are you today?
I'm great. I'm going to be in Missoula in a couple of weeks.
And I'm going to be there.
Great.
I'm going to be there. What I wanted to say, I have actually two comments. One is that the administration doesn't really give a hoot about what Iraqis believe, feel, think, or suffer. They're just interested in making Baghdad a big city, the U.S. establishment surrounded by a great big oil field, because people are leaving there in droves.
Mm-hmm.
People that we were supposed to liberate are leaving, 4 million refugees and a lot of people.
2 million internally displaced and 2 million, more than 2 million who have left. Who have
no, we had this fake, we had this so-called election, and after that everything just went to pot. And, you know, we're not there to help anybody. And I really am offended that I have to have enemies that are chosen for me, or I'm supposed to like or dislike people, or, you know, like I don't have anything between my ears except a lot of hot air, and that's what's being passed on to us. We have a $792 million embassy on prime acreage in Baghdad, and we have 14 permanent bases there. We're not there to help anybody but ourselves, and that's really a sad comment for this country.
Yep, well
that's
said.
What I think.
Yep, well said, Joan. Thank you very much for the call. And in fact, let's even take it beyond that. I would submit to you that we're not just there for the bases and we're not just there for the oil. That George Bush, back in 1999, when his family hired Mickey Herskowitz to write his autobiography, A Charge to Keep, which you can buy in bookstores now, the guy that he originally hired, who did hundreds of hours of interviews with George Bush, said the following. This is Cindy Sheehan quoting him in sworn testimony before John Conyers Committee.
As a matter of fact, in interviews in 1999 with respected journalist and longtime Bush family friend Mickey Herskowitz, then Governor George Bush stated, "One of the keys to being seen as a great leader is to be seen as commander-in-chief. My father had all this political capital built up when he drove the Iraqis out of Kuwait, and he wasted it. If I have a chance to invade, if I had that much capital, I'm not going to waste it. I'm going to get everything passed that I want to get passed, and I'm going to have a successful presidency," end quote.
In other words, Bush invaded Iraq because it was politically expedient. It would help the Republican Party take back the Senate in the 2002 and 2004 elections and solidify it in the 2004 elections and help him get reelected in 2004. And in fact, to the extent that he was reelected, which I think is quite arguable, it worked brilliantly. As war usually does. War does unite people. Tragically. Quinn in Sunnyvale, California. Hey, Quinn.
Hi there. So John McCain is now the presumptive nominee, and I think it's time for Barack to change his sights from Hillary and start going over on John McCain.
I agree. I think both of them should.
I don't think Hillary's going to, though. I think Hillary's going to continue to go after Barack, and we just need to accept that. So what Obama needs to do is to publicly state that, you know, there's two of us, there's one of him, we can both work together, showing why we'd be the better candidate going after McCain. trying to raise the field and then allowing Hillary to make the choice.
Yeah, I think this thing yesterday of, you know, where are her tax returns was just, you know, he could have, to the extent that his campaign spent any time on that at all, they could have spent so much better time on, you know, why do you have Charlie Black, a lobbyist, out there going on national television talking about how you're not, you don't have so many lobbyists on your campaign. I mean,
exactly.
that kind of issue. McQuinn, thanks a lot for your call. Well said. Joe in Los Angeles. Hey, Joe, just got a half a minute here before the break. What's up?
I think you're off on that interpretation of the Hillary ad. My wife's dark, and I saw that ad, and the whole ad's dark. I mean, I think the subtleness of sexism is prevalent, and no one's dealing with it. Obama's made some comments that I totally saw as sexist, and I just...
For example?
After she lost a couple of things, he made twice in a row. One week after another, he said, oh, she must be tired. Oh, she's something like cranky. There was a comment about her claws coming out.
Actually, that was not a comment about her claws. It was a general comment. You cannot find a statement where he talks about Hillary Clinton's claws. It's not there. But you know, I get it. You know, sexism is real and it's out there, and racism is real and it's out there, and I hope I'm wrong. Not I'm wrong. It wasn't my suggestion in the first place. But I hope the folks over at the Daily Kos who are convinced that the Clinton ad has darkened Obama. I hope that it's all wrong. 27 minutes after.
This is the Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
Oh, no, it's not. It's not the end of it. It's just another day. Here we go. We're 34 minutes past the hour. Another day in America, right? Christy Harvey is with us. She is the Director of Strategic Communications for the Center for American Progress and the editor of My Check Radio, mycheckradio.com or .org. Which is it, Christy?
It's .org.
.org. Thank you very much. Great to have you with us. And the FBI is looking into the GOP. There's money missing. This is just like the $8 billion missing in Iraq. Gee, we don't know where it went. It just vanished.
This is the craziest. I saw this story this morning and went, oh my God, I kind of need to talk to Tom right now. Like, I have been almost calling you since 8 o'clock in the morning since I saw this. It's crazy. But, yeah, there's this huge, huge breaking scandal at the National Republican Congressional Committee, we call it the NRCC, which is the main Republican fundraising arm of the House of Representatives. This is where the House gets its money to run for office.
Right.
And it turns out the NRCC is missing hundreds of thousands of dollars.
And it's also missing Christopher J. Ward, the treasurer.
It's also missing, yes, Treasurer Christopher J. Ward. He abruptly left the organization a couple of weeks ago. And it turns out that he was the treasurer, but Representative Mike Conway, who is a CPA, was the head of the NRCC auditing committee. And he started to smell something kind of fishy with the books. Mm-hmm. And said to Mr. Ward, I'd like to see all of the audits. These aren't looking really great to me. Meet with the outside auditing firm we use and you and just figure out there's something going on here. And Christopher Ward dodged him, finally set up a meeting. And 30 minutes before the meeting, he emailed Mr. Representative Conway and said, here's the thing. There's no outside auditing committee.
Mm-hmm.
All of the audits since 2003 have been faked.
Faked? I mean, literally he used the word faked?
And I don't know exactly what the email said, but they have determined that since 2003, every single audit was made up basically in the brain of Mr. Ward.
Mm-hmm.
And they cannot find hundreds of thousands of dollars. So they immediately called the FBI, and the FBI has announced that they are starting a criminal investigation. Now, why this also gets bad is Mr. Ward also acted as a personal fundraiser slash financial liaison for a whole bunch of Republican congressmen. And now, for example, Congressman Rodney Alexander of Louisiana has stepped forward and said he's missing all this money from his personal campaign accounts.
Hmm.
And they're telling everybody to look in your books because you might not have the money that you think you have.
Does Mr. Ward have a new mansion in Las Vegas?
They're looking into that, but this is the part you're going to love. Ask me, please, what Mr. Ward did before he became the auditor for the NRCC.
What did Mr. Ward do before he became the auditor for the National Republican Congressional Committee?
I'm glad you asked me that, Tom. He was actually a partner in a consulting firm that bankrolled and worked for the Swift Boat Vets.
You're kidding.
So I just love that angle.
You're
because
kidding.
You know, if you hired the guy behind the Swift Boat Vets to look at your books, I mean, he's going to steal, right?
Yeah.
I also love that he was such a weasel that he admitted to all of this 30 minutes before the fake meeting in an email.
Right.
Didn't call anybody, didn't actually show man up and go to the meeting. He sent some weaselly email that said, yeah, here's the thing, there's no money. I took it.
Incredible. Now, let me toss one at you.
Sure.
Are you familiar with the United Technologies Diebold deal?
I've heard of it, but I'm not...
Charlie Black, the guy who went on TV, the lobbyist, who went on TV weekend before last to suggest that John McCain is not, his campaign is not surrounded by lobbyists, and Tim Russert never called him out as a lobbyist. Charlie Black is the founder of BKSH and Associates, a lobbying firm, and a major lobbyist.
Okay.
He's a lobbyist for United Technologies. United Technologies, 5 days ago, offered to buy Diebold.
Right.
At 60% above market value. 2 days ago, Diebold said no. Yesterday, United Technologies says, we're going to buy you anyway, and we're going to try and close the deal here before the election. So Charlie Black, the guy who's the head, one of the leaders of McCain's campaign committee, one of his senior advisors, is a lobbyist for the defense contractor that's trying to buy the voting machine company. And here's where it gets even weirder. Charlie Black's boss, his company has been acquired by Burston Marsteller Worldwide. That company is headed by Mark Penn, who is heading up Hillary Clinton's campaign.
That's really weird.
Tell me that, you know, truth is not stranger than fiction.
Okay, I've got one for you then.
All right, your turn.
Did you hear where all the lobbyists are having their big ethics convention this year?
Oh, no. Las Vegas, right?
Yes.
It's
Campaigns
be.
And Elections magazine is having an ethics conference called All Things Ethical in Sin City.
Right.
So I guess between, you know, the slots tables or the nudie bars or whatever you do when you're in Vegas, you can go to panels. And the panels are actually called, for example, there was one called Using Phones Ethically, or my favorite, The Ethics of Deception.
Amazing.
Because where better to get lobbyists to talk about ethics than in Vegas?
Now, yes, indeed. It's just bizarre. Now, speaking of let's look at the antithesis of bizarre. Canada has actually decided to do the right thing. This is a big story.
This is a big story, and I don't think it's getting enough play here in the States, but I think this is huge. Yeah, the Canadian government has decided it will no longer use the evidence that the CIA got from their interrogations of top Al-Qaeda detainee who was waterboarded. And this is a big deal because this is a controversy that's going on here, whether or not you can use statements made by someone while they're being tortured as evidence against them in an actual court of law.
Well, and in fact, the U.S., the Bush administration is asserting that they can, they will, and that at least six or seven of those guys are going to get the death penalty. And when the judge who was in charge of this stuff said, wait a minute, are going to get the death penalty? They said, yeah, and he quit.
Right, exactly. And this is a big deal because as these supposed trials start up down here, they're also having some investigations up in Canada and trials up in Canada. And the Canadian Security Intelligence Service, CSIS, last month, very quietly, but they still withdrew all of the statements made by one Al-Qaeda leader that had been made during his interrogation by the CIA. So they're actually, you know, that's always been the law. You know,
right.
You don't use statements obtained under torture because, for one thing, they're usually completely unreliable.
Right.
And for the other, you know, it discourages torture because you know that you can't use what you gain when you're actively hurting someone, putting them in pain. So I think it'll be interesting to see what, if any, response the White House makes to this.
Yeah. Another way of saying number two is we are not barbarians.
Right.
But apparently we are, or at least our administration is. The, you know, Orrin Hatch's office had a guy who had hacked into Teddy Kennedy's computer back in 2002, 2003. And throughout the hearings for various judges, the Democrats couldn't figure out why the Republicans always knew their strategy in advance and were out ahead of them. For over a year, this guy had hacked into Teddy Kennedy's computer and apparently several other Democrats on the Judiciary Committee. He was finally outed. He was Orrin Hatch denounced him and fired him. This is all public record. There's never been an investigation of it, to the best of my knowledge. But what we know is that when Republicans have access to the data of Democrats, they use it. We know that from the Nixon administration. We know that from just a couple of years ago during the Bush administration. Mm-hmm. And now, if I understand correctly, we're discovering that the Bushies haven't just been having the phone companies vacuum up all our data, illegally, but that the FBI has been doing this with national security letters.
Oh, this is just, it's so dirty. Yeah, these national security letters are these sort of asterisks to the law that say that the FBI can get personal data without a warrant. It's basically another way of warrantless wiretap, but this one is for your banks or your emails or your phones or your home. It's how they can get into your house without letting you know and that sort of thing. And they're supposed to be used very scarcely. And it was put into the Patriot Act that the FBI could use these as long as they said they were looking for terrorists. And Congress yesterday found out from FBI Director Mueller that the FBI has been improperly using these security letters to spy on Americans. And the whole time they've been saying, you know, when asked before, they were saying, you know, we don't use these. If we do use these, we can't tell you because it's classified, but we don't. Mm-hmm. And then we found out last year that an internal audit showed that they actually had used them, and we just didn't know how many times. But now we know that they have been used carelessly. They were used in the wrong circumstances against the wrong people, you know, just average, ordinary Americans not doing anything wrong.
What about against members, Democratic members of the House or Senate? Any indications that that's a possibility? I mean, that's what Nixon did. He had the FBI spying on his political enemies from Martin Luther King on down.
It's a good question. They haven't come forward with any specifics or names. It's just been numbers and the fact that this happened. But you have to wonder if they're, I mean, they're actually saying, we were wrong, we used these improperly, we spied on people we shouldn't have been spying on.
Right. But they're not saying, by the way, here's who we spied on.
Right. And they're not saying, and sorry, Speaker Pelosi,
Put a tinfoil hat on me. I am ready to believe it because we've seen it in this administration and we've seen it in the Nixon administration.
I love nothing more than a good conspiracy, so I'll stay with you on that one.
Okay, Christy Harvey, Director of Strategic Communications for the Center for American Progress, AmericanProgress.org, and MikeCheckRadio.org. Christy, thank you.
Thank you.
It's always great talking to you every week. 45 minutes past the hour. Stick around. We'll be right back.
Tom Hartman Program, taking back the mainstream media.
3 hours a day,
5 days a week.
Burning up the atmosphere and cutting down the trees. The billion-dollar bombing of a nation on his knees. Anyone not marching to their tune, they call it treason. Everyone says God is on his side. See the lightning, hear the cries of the wounded in a world in holy war. Mortal thunder from the skies, killing everything they say they're fighting for.
So the House Republicans tried to bring their little FISA bill to the floor again. They lost, 221 to 191. Nonetheless, we have to keep this thing going. Need to keep the whole discussion going. Keep people awake on this thing and keep calling your member of Congress. But it seems to be working. Calling your member of the House of Representatives. You go to callcongress.org. All the phone numbers are right there. 866-303-2270. Our telephone number, Fred in New York City. Hey, Fred, what's on your mind today?
Tom, I must commend you for your educational program daily.
Thank you.
I'm a long-time listener, a first-time caller. I just have two things to say. One is that it appears to me that this whole primary was tailor-made for Hillary Clinton. Secondly, it seems as if Clinton is not the nominee, no one else should the Democratic Party should just lose the election. That's my impression because of the behavior that I have seen throughout the whole campaign.
That's your impression of what's real or what the Clinton campaign believes to be real?
It's either she or no one else.
In your opinion?
Yes, gets the nominee.
I see. Okay, interesting. So you'd vote for John McCain. I wouldn't. Sorry, I wouldn't. Eleanor Adler is with us with the Talk Radio News Service in Washington, D.C., talkradionews.com, their new and spiffy website. Hey, Ellen.
Well, we're even going to get a newer one even in shorter order. I guess today both the Senate leadership had a pen and pencil and Nancy Pelosi had a press conference. Both of them were asked about the elections. Both of them put it back off onto the DNC and what was going to happen on that. And
rightfully so, actually.
Absolutely rightfully so. They said that they don't want to get involved, that they want a nominee by the time the convention happens for obvious reasons.
Mm-hmm.
Also today, the other issue that is coming up has to do with the whole issue of earmarks and what's going to happen. Of course, the Republicans are trying to put in something on the House saying that they are going to go after earmarks and they want to stop all of them.
Isn't this a lot of window dressing? I mean, earmarks are just a tiny fraction of the federal budget. They're not even a percent of the federal budget.
It is, and particularly because the Republicans had complete earmarks. I mean, they were like the earmark kings and queens.
Oh, they were hog wild about earmarks, but even at that, it probably never got over 2% of the budget.
No, absolutely not. I mean, it's never been a huge amount. But don't forget, we don't even give 0.07 of our GDP to foreign aid. So that's an issue. Now,
point taken.
Also,
yeah.
The contempt issue came up in the Nancy Pelosi press conference, and she said that
this is the contempt of Congress by Harriet Myers and Karl Rove.
Exactly, and
or Josh Bolton.
Right. And she, the speaker said that the House passes their own, the Senate passes their own, but she said the Senate has some arrows in their quiver and that make them have a lot more tough ability, on this issue than the House has. And I don't know
what that means.
But I think it means more subpoena power. I'm not exactly sure.
Now, the House actually has a jail downstairs, you know, and they have a sergeant at arms, but I don't know if they can extradite somebody from Texas.
I don't know that they can either, and I don't think Harriet Myers is going to show up in Washington too soon.
Yeah.
She also said that there's 17 members of the House Republican Judiciary Committee. They've gone on record for their dissenting views. She also was very, very tough on the Chinese. She said that the Chinese ownership of our debt is about $900 billion. She said that means they have lots of leverage over our debt, and she is very, very concerned about that.
Yeah, well, and that's a very legitimate concern, and that's, again, a direct response of Reaganomics. This whole idea, you know, Dick Cheney just before the 2000 election said, Reagan showed us the deficits don't matter, the debt doesn't matter. And he was so wrong. I mean, what Reagan showed us is that debt will kill us. And it is.
Right. Also, Senator John McCain came up both in the Senate conference and Nancy Pelosi's conference, and she was both are very, very concerned about what happened. Actually, Patty Murray was asked directly about this deal that did not go to Boeing, and she said Boeing was not even told what specifications were made on this tanker deal that allowed Northrop Grumman and Airbus to get the contract.
Yeah, this is the thing that blew my mind, was that the Air Force came out with this whole dog and pony show about how superior the Airbus plane was to the Boeing plane, and I'm going, why didn't somebody spec this thing? Why, you know, I mean, usually when you do an RFB, you say, you know, here's the specs that we're looking for, offer a bid on this. And how did you get two completely different airplanes, one acceptable, one unacceptable, when they should have been bidding on the same? The Air Force should have been designing the specs on this.
That's usually what happens. And don't forget, I mean, Patty Murray would not go and blame McCain, but many people in the Air Force have blamed him for scuttling that original deal with Boeing. And then, you know, sort of the whole thing was kind of changed by the Air Force. Nobody knows how or
did when. Did he blow it up with Boeing because he's taking money from campaign lobbyists for Airbus?
That is something we're going to all have to take a look at.
Good on you. Okay. Well, Ellen Ratner with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com. Thank you, Ellen.
Thank you.
Talk to you tomorrow. 56 minutes past. Well, it's the end of the show here. We'll be back tomorrow. Coming up Friday, Senator Bernie Sanders, Brunch with Bernie, and Dr. Ravi Batra, our favorite economist, is going to come on and answer your questions. And don't forget, my friends, democracy begins with you. Activism begins with you. Get out there. Get active. Tag, you're it. See you tomorrow.
This is the Tom Hartman Program. For exclusive audio archives and more information, visit TomHartmanRadio.com.